Good morning. For the first time, the number of HIV cases in Europe has increased to over 2 million, and the new cases are a 7% rise over last year. On this World AIDS Day, we talk with Dr. Cecilia Shikuma about the implications of the increase and the state of HIV/AIDS in Hawaii. Plus, a labor law that was supposed to start today now seems more of a business choice than compliance. HR specialist Debbie Padello joins us with advice for businesses. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk. Christopher O'Reilly, himself an acclaimed classical pianist, knows what it takes to build a performing career. The From the Top host is in Hawaii to hear the best of Hawaii's young performers and give a concert of his own. And kalo, the staple food that has sustained Hawaiians for centuries, will be celebrated in all its variety at the Waipa Kalo Fest on Kauai.
That's the conversation for this Thursday, December 1st. Now news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vanderkirk. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
There's a perception out there, perhaps, that the worst of the HIV epidemic is behind us, right?
And that can be a very dangerous assumption.
Yeah.
As we're finding out with a report that's out this week. Now, you know that this week, that report that came out from the World Health Organization is providing, as you suggest, another reason to focus on HIV and AIDS. For the first time, the cumulative number of HIV cases in Europe has increased to over 2 million. That includes a 7% rise in new cases since last year and the highest annual number since reporting began in the 1980s. On this World AIDS Day, we wanted to know how that report compares to Hawaii now. According to the Hawaii Department of Health's latest report, there are just under 4,700 HIV cases, but the same DOH report says that diagnosed cases of HIV in the most recent years, 2012 through 14, are incomplete due to delays in reporting. So we called Dr. Cecilia Shikuma, the director of the Hawaii Center for AIDS, and she's on the line with us this morning. Good morning, Dr. Shikuma. Thank you so much for being here.
Good morning.
Good to talk to you again. Now, how are you assessing this report that's come out of the World Health Organization showing this sort of unprecedented rise in the cases in Europe?
Yeah, well, you know, I think it, you state, it's a reminder that HIV is not over, that we really need to keep pressure and make sure that we can minimize the number of HIV infections. I think it's particularly important because currently we cannot cure HIV. So the main emphasis is on prevention.
When we look at AIDS, very often we talk about it, thoughts tend to go immediately to Africa. Two-thirds of the cases mm-hmm. are there. But this seems to be a real reminder that, you know, that's not the only place where AIDS or HIV is found, and that the fact that it's now on the rise in Europe should mean that with travel, with people now far more mobile than perhaps they've ever been, that this is a deep concern. What are you doing to be able to bring some of that into our consciousness, particularly here in Hawaii?
Well, you know, I think it's not just Europe, but there is a rise in HIV in other parts of the world as well, for example, in China and Southeast Asia. I think what's different about these epidemics is that there is a difference in the population that it seems to be increasing in, and I think we need to be, as a society, very aware of who's at risk and what to do to protect yourself.
Okay, so who is at risk now, and then we'll talk a little bit later about protection.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, HIV does not discriminate. So that, you know, whether you're young or old, you are at risk. But, you know, HIV seems to particularly be hitting hard at individuals who have a lifestyle that's conducive to it, and particularly men who have sex with men, and those that for whom intravenous drug abuse is a problem.
So, as that's obviously the case, it's been around for a while. Though, you know, there are a lot of people who thought, didn't we get the message out about protection? Wasn't there a greater case made about how you had to approach this, mm-hmm. so that, you know, you don't have to live with HIV or AIDS or potentially die from it? It seems in some ways that it's regarded differently now than it has been in past, not as dire, you know, not as, fatal,
mm-hmm.
because
mm-hmm.
people are living longer, or the various cocktails that people are taking. That seems to have thwarted what you talk about in terms of prevention.
Right. Yeah, you know, I think there's been some tendency to be very lax about it. It's true that with good antiretroviral therapy, we can keep people alive and reasonably healthy, not completely, but reasonably healthy for a very long time to come. But, you know, there are still consequences, and it's not a disease that you would wish on anyone. I think there's been a difference in how we approach HIV. You know, it used to be that in the old days, we would go to high schools, various civic groups, and say, okay, you know, use condoms, use safe sex, don't have sex outside marriage, those kinds of things. And we're finding that a more target approach, dealing with the individuals that are particularly at risk, are probably more effective.
Dr. Shikuma, in all that prevention activity, though, mm-hmm. once somebody, you know, comes and says, I have an issue here, and it's found to be that they do, in fact, have HIV, how many of those individuals actually seek treatment? I mean, we hear that there's a real disparity between those who may know and those who may seek treatment.
Yeah, well, you know, globally, it's felt that that we don't, it's 1 in 7 people with HIV are not diagnosed, which is scary because they themselves don't know that they're HIV infected, and they can spread HIV unknowingly. I think in Hawaii, the State Department's pretty confident that it's less of an issue in HIV, because the rates of a new diagnosis have been pretty stable over time, at about 80 to 100 cases every year.
That said, though, I mean, going back to the point of, you know, once somebody is diagnosed, mm-hmm. how accessible is the treatment, and how likely is someone to seek treatment?
Mm-hmm. I can only speak to what the situation is in Hawaii, because as you could imagine, it really varies from region to region. But the Department of Health here in Hawaii has a very aggressive approach to individuals that are diagnosed with HIV, so that there is a tracking of these individuals and a real emphasis on helping these individuals get to treatment and providing the appropriate antiretroviral therapy for them.
In the latest report, the surveillance report that we saw from the Hawaii DOH, they say pointedly in there, as we said in the opening, that for the years 2012 through 14, that the data is incomplete because of delays in reporting, so we really don't know how many diagnosed cases of HIV we had during those years, or presumably what we have now. Do you have any better data?
No. I think our Department of Health has the best data. I think it's small, though, you know, because over time these individuals will get diagnosed because they become sick.
At this point, where we're having what seems to be a redirect of attention mm-hmm. back to HIV and AIDS, is there, in your mind, going to be another campaign or something other than what we have seen in past to also refocus our attention on a daily basis?
Yes. I think that there are actually two paradigm shifts on how we should approach HIV. And one is, as I said, we know that certain individuals are more at risk than others, particularly people who use IV drugs and also those men who have sex with men. And we now have good drugs that's safe, that if you take these medications every day, it can prevent these individuals from getting HIV. It's called PrEP, or pre-exposure prophylaxis. And the Center for Disease Control has really, come out on record saying that they would really recommend these medications for anyone who is at higher risk for HIV.
Right. I mean, that's for someone who might be in that high-risk category. So you're
right.
Saying that that we're going to see maybe more of those things, or maybe we won't even see that in the general public in the way that we saw some of the campaigns mm-hmm. in many, many years past? I mean, are you talking about being that targeted to where this is not going to be out there in general awareness, but more targeted to certain organizations, certain groups?
That's right. It's felt that a more targeted approach would be more effective.
Right.
And one of the other, things we know now is that, and it should be relatively intuitively obvious, that it takes an HIV-infected individual to spread HIV. So that there's a lot of emphasis on identifying who's HIV infected. And as you said, once they're infected, getting them into good treatment to shut down their virus so that they really cannot spread HIV.
Dr. Shikuma, we've got to go now, but I thank you very much for making time for us this morning.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Cecilia Shikuma is the director of the Hawaii Center for AIDS. She's also professor of medicine and the Edwin C. Cadman Endowed Chair at UH Manoa John A. Burns School of Medicine. She's also the recipient of numerous HIV-related research grants from the National Institute of Health to research chronic non-infectious complications of HIV.
At 8:15, you're listening to The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up from the tops, Christopher O'Reilly talks about the preparation that goes into a concert performance. But first, your backyard quiz.
Umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholabe, ohawaiti.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're looking at a cinema classic filmed in Hawaii. That alone doesn't set this film much apart. There have been almost 100 movies filmed in Hawaii since the early days of the film industry. Hawaii is a place that's been a major presence in movies, serving as the setting for more than 50 films. However, there's one prominent movie that has earned a unique distinction in Hawaii filmmaking. That production was filming on Kauai when the devastating Hurricane Iniki made landfall in 1992. The majority of the cast and crew hunkered down and rode out the storm, but a few intrepid camera operators made a point to capture shots of the passing storm. Their reason? Several scenes of the film were set during a major hurricane. Those scenes incorporating the real-life footage of Hurricane Iniki made the final cut and have been seen by millions who watched this mega hit. So, do you know which film we're talking about? If you do, you can call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And if you're first and right, you get the prize.
Aloha, I'm Ed Texera, formerly of Hawaii State Civil Defense. You're tuned to HPR2 Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear on the show at facebook.com/HIConversation.
The young performers we hear each weekend on Christopher O'Reilly's NPR program From the Top know that their host, a seasoned and highly acclaimed pianist who gives concerts around the world, shares their love of music and knows what it takes to become a concert artist. He makes them comfortable and always seems to bring out their best. He's in Hawaii to bring out the best in young local musicians, in concerts to be broadcast later on From the Top, and to give a concert of his own. We talked about the hard work that goes into preparing a piece of music for the concert stage.
Anytime that you're excited about learning something, it really is just about the journey. And sometimes some pieces take longer than others, but I think the inception of the idea of falling in love with a piece of music really makes a large difference in getting that idea of difficulty or challenge to be superfluous and really beside the point.
Once you get past the technical demands of a piece, you have a kind of an emotional connection to be made, yeah?
I think so. That can also be sometimes, I think in professional realms, that can be sort of a hindrance. I know people who I've heard play pieces that they think are the most incredibly personal and important pieces in their repertoire, and somehow it just doesn't connect. So I think in some cases it can be a matter of, you know, I know there was one time I was playing a chamber music piece none of us liked playing, but we actually figured, well, you know, he must have had something in mind and he wrote this with a purpose, so our job is to take the notes off the page and project them with all of the directions at our disposal. And that became a much more compelling performance. So I think if it's too personal, I think it's perhaps not a good thing.
Can almost be a hindrance then.
Yeah, it can be.
And what you're saying in the instance you just described, you sort of by approaching it through very specific technical demands of the piece, it sounds as if you found your way to an emotional connection through that.
Yes. I mean, you really have to approach each piece of music as, well, you know, they wrote it on purpose. They did it this way, and they worked on it and honed it and polished it, and so this is a work of art that deserves respect, and so we need to get as much information as we can glean from the composer's directions, and that's the best one can do. I also do think that there is a certain amount to be said for playing a piece of music over the course of a lifetime.
Yeah.
Part of what makes what makes music such a universal language is that sense of different connections with a piece of music over time. In particular, when we're dealing with different social situations or resonances in our society, in our hearts, in our family, in our personal lives, to which we bring to bear on a particular piece of music. And it's very different in one part of your life and different again in another. I'm finding more and more now that pianistic music that I've loved for many years, I realize, comes more from a lyric and vocal impetus. When you look at the music of Beethoven, it's fairly purely pianistic. Mm-hmm. But when you're looking at the music of Bach, of Mozart, of Brahms, these are people who really spent most of their time writing vocal music.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm really getting a lot more fun out of playing that music with that in mind.
So you can almost find a key to an interpretation of a piano piece by thinking of it as a sung piece.
Yes, and of course, you know, we all have to deal with the fact that, you know, we're all doing approximations of the best and most true musical instrument, which is, in fact, the human voice. So trying to always strive with a percussive instrument as we have on the piano at our disposal, striving for that lyricism, that vocal sustain, is something that, you know, it really makes every day playing the piano a great challenge and a great inspiration.
some of the nuances that make vocal music so effective come from nuances of pitch that the piano really isn't equipped to provide.
Well, I don't think that's true. I think the nuance in vocal music has more to do with the fact that they're dealing with words. If we look at articulation in piano music, I like to think that there's a great variety of staccato, I think it's much more easy to digest that idea when you realize that every note of a vocal piece is associated with a syllable, of which there are innumerable types mm-hmm. in various different languages. So that's why, I don't hear Glenn Gould having a set it and forget it kind of articulative stance. I really hear words when he plays. So if it's a scale passage, I'm hearing a narrative. I'm hearing a great variety of color within a rather slim parameter of articulative vocabulary.
Do you find yourself hearing words when you play a piece like that?
I do. I also find that it's that various articulations are really an invitation for freedom and variation. If you look at it from that standpoint, there are rests and there are rests. There are rests that are breaths. There mm-hmm. are rests that are interruptions. There are staccatos that, on the Stravinskian side of the spectrum, would be as short as you can play it. And on the other end of the spectrum, you go with the Berlin Philharmonic chapter and verse, which says that staccato is meant to be half the printed length. So if you're looking at a staccato quarter note, that's a pretty long note. It's an eighth note, really. So you've really got a lot of variety and possibility for variation that I find quite enlightening and inspiring.
That's really where the individual artist's interpretive skills come to bear, yeah?
I agree, yes.
Christopher O'Reilly is the host of National Public Radio's From the Top, which is heard on HPR 1 Saturdays at 10 a.m. He'll be recording his program before a live audience tomorrow evening at Blaisdell Concert Hall in Honolulu, and he'll play a solo concert Saturday afternoon at 4 p.m. in our Atherton Performing Arts Studio. You can find out more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Hawaii Public Radio is grateful for the support of our listeners and for our many community partners. Those include Kumakahua Theater, First Insurance Company, and Windward Choral Society. Thank you all so much for your generosity and participation during our recent on-air campaign.
Good morning. I'm Euclena Luli from Kailua, Oahu. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
A new study finds that an approach to criminal justice might not reduce recidivism and save taxpayer money. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has today's reality check. Welcome back.
Good morning. How do I sound, Beth?
Much better than you did the other day. Yes, much better. And hope you're getting better, too. Now, we're talking about the HOPE program, the Hawaii's Opportunity Probation with Enforcement program that was started by First Circuit Court Judge Steve Alm. That has gone on to great acclaim. Now it's in 31 states.
Right.
What gives with this new study?
Well, the study said basically that HOPE is not a silver bullet when it comes to reducing recidivism, that in fact it doesn't lower cost. And so what these groups did, Penn State and an organization on criminal justice reform, they studied 1,500 probationers in four different states. And what they found out is didn't matter whether they went through a HOPE-type probation program or what people call probation as usual. There was no real difference in the outcome. And therefore, if you will, casting doubt on whether HOPE is quite the model that so many people say it is, in particular Steve Alm.
Did the that study include those from Hawaii or some from Hawaii?
No, they were four different locations, other states, including one or two states where HOPE has actually been quite successful. And there's no question, as you mentioned at the top, 31 states have adopted HOPE and seen all sorts of progress. Well, I called Steve Alm himself. He's now stepped down from the court. He's actually in D.C., and he's still very much on the HOPE beat, promoting the program, trying to implement it elsewhere. And he criticized the study. First of all, he said, look, there's been criticism of HOPE since the very beginning. He says it's usually from academics. They don't understand HOPE. They don't understand probation. They fail to recognize that, in fact, it's a bad thing that probation, as usual, is sending more people back to jail. Too much focus on sanctioning and not enough focus on helping people. So he was pretty strong in his denunciation. By the way, this study comes out at the same time as a number of other studies have been published together. At least one or two other studies points to success with the HOPE program.
I mean, this is sort of always the way, isn't it, where you've got some that are detractors and some that clearly are supporting it, trying to go back and pull out the underpinnings of those studies to see really how they were doing it and what that methodology might have revealed is part of all of this. So what's the big takeaway from this for today, that it works for some and doesn't for others?
Yeah, in fact, that's exactly how the editor of the journal that put all these studies together described it. No one size fits all. You have to take a nuanced, multifaceted approach. Each community, each state, each county to county is different when it comes to probation. Let's take the methods that work. Let's try and fix the things that are not working. I will add, by the way, at least one critic locally, Keith Kaneshiro, the city prosecutor, he said the study wasn't a surprise at all. It actually reflects what he sees every day. He says HOPE is not working. But as we know, Keith Kaneshiro has a very strong view on probation and parole and criminal justice. But bottom line, the takeaway is one size does not fit all. Work on it. Try and improve the system.
All right. We're going to leave it there. Thanks so much. And we'll hopefully talk to you tomorrow.
I'll be singing blues tomorrow night.
Oh, maybe you'll really be singing the blues if you have no voice. Thanks very much. We'll talk to you soon. Chad Blair joins us every day from Civil Beat with a reality check. Today in the U.S., we were supposed to have the federal Fair Labor Standards go into effect. It would have changed how and which employees would be compensated for overtime. 21 states had filed a lawsuit over the rule, and last week, a U.S. federal court judge in Texas issued an injunction to the application of the rules and said it applied to all states. With many businesses having already made preparation, they're now in limbo, the injunction has effectively made a federal law more of a choice than a means of compliance. So we called HR specialist Debbie Padello from Simplicity HR by AllTrust to see what advice she has for businesses on what they're supposed to do now in on a date marking a labor milestone.
Today would have been a really big day for over 16,000 employees in the state of Hawaii alone. And that would have been where changes would have been put into place and basically changing their status from either a salary manager position to an hourly position, or where their wage would increase to meet a new salary threshold, which would be almost double what it was currently. And so a lot of big changes for small businesses in Hawaii were to go into effect today.
And many of them have been preparing this for a while, really looking at what does it mean to be a salaried employee, where in many cases your salary may be based on a 40-hour work week, but clearly you're not working a 40-hour work week, and trying to create some fairness with that so that people were being paid for time that they were actually expending up to a certain point. When you get to be into, you know, upper middle and senior management, there are just different expectations at times. But now we have this judge who has decided that, no, this shouldn't go forward and has issued an injunction. How are you assessing his move relative to a federal act that you know, should have been complied with, where now it seems to be more arbitrary or at least a matter of personal purview for a business.
Mm-hmm. Yes, up to last week, Tuesday, when the injunction was ruled, it really was a big compliance decision for businesses, and they really needed to look at granularly every position within their organization to determine if they would be compliant with this new ruling that would have gone into effect today. And so it's not just at the position, but the individual, because it went down to salary and their work. And so businesses, especially all the small businesses in Hawaii, the nonprofits, really needed to look at their bottom line on top of that to really decide, what's the impact going to be on my business for someone in this particular position who I would need to give an increase of even $5,000, $8,000 a year, or many people in that category that maybe were making about $40,000, that now needed to make $47,600 to be compliant. And so businesses, we've been working with our clients since the summer, reaching out to thousands of businesses saying, let's talk about this, let's strategize, let's look at your business bottom line, let's look at what's going on in your organization. Can they really fulfill the requirements of a position working 40 hours a week, or do they work more than 40 hours a week? And what should we do to ensure that you're compliant? But with that injunction last week, Tuesday, that went into effect, they no longer needed to make a compliance decision. Now they're making a business decision, because they probably communicated these changes to employees and whether they were going to increase their pay or change their exempt status. So at this point, once you've already told somebody, hey, you're going to get an increase, or hey, you're no longer salary, I'm going to pay you for your overtime hours, to take that back really does play a huge impact on morale. And so that's something that businesses really need to consider is, okay, what should I do? But how is this going to affect the morale of my company?
Do you know of specific incidents, without outing anybody, but to be able to talk to them, or have you talk to them to say just that of, you know, if you retract this, if you walk this back, you're going to run the risk of having a very serious morale problem. And is it really going to be that much more for you to have to come up with X amount of dollars, obviously depending upon the size of the business?
Yes, we've had many discussions like that, because 9 times out of 10, it was already communicated to the employees within those businesses. And so retracting this decision because of the injunction definitely plays a big impact on morale. So we're talking with different businesses on what those impacts are going to be, what even what the job market is looking like nowadays. You know, it's so hard to find great people. And so is it really worth those thousands of dollars, which is still money? But what if you lose that individual in the long run? You know, let's really talk it through and or see what other things are going on with that employee or the company culture. And so having those deeper discussions. So the 3-step process to make a decision is now really unraveling a bigger discussion with businesses and looking at it from that HR perspective of company morale and company culture.
In the end, though, there's still the bottom line. If you don't have the money to do it, you can't do it. And for some businesses, particularly small businesses, where they have people who are salaried and who maybe were expecting this, or maybe took a, you know, a peremptory step and began to make adjustments and shifts even beforehand,
mm-hmm.
How are they responding to this differently than perhaps a very large employer who's also looking at big bottom line issues and a big amount of money that's going to have to go in there to meet what they thought was going to be a federal law, but now is up in the air?
Well, a lot of our larger clients, when we're looking at the impact on them, yes, a small business, let's say it may impact 1 to 3 to 5 employees in that category. But then you do have those larger businesses that it would impact 10 to 15 to 20 people that would fall into that category. So yes, it does.
Or hundreds.
Exactly. It does impact people. But I believe whether they're small business or large business, there's still an impact based on how many employees are actually within the organization that fall into this limbo stage, you know, that we're in right now. It's a really challenging position to be in for businesses right now that need to make this decision. It's a risk, you know, where if I proceed and make the changes, then great. How does that affect my bottom line? If I don't proceed, how does that affect my company morale? And if they, for some reason, which they could at any time make this ruling stand and do it retroactively to today, let's say in June, they say, hey, we're making this go into effect and we're going to make it retroactive to December 1. At that point, businesses will need to retroactively pay the employees that they didn't convert and make compliant as if this FLSA ruling went into effect. So that's a risk that businesses have to take if they want to wait it out and see and be subject to retroactive wages, or if they proceed and move forward as if it was standing. And I believe even the Department of Labor at this point is still in limbo as well, where they're wanting to push forward. But yet there's things that are going on that, you know, it's all a wait and see, especially with the new administration coming into play. There's a lot of factors and a lot of moving parts.
If, in fact, they do have to pay and it does become retroactive, that's a lot of cash that's going to have to be available pretty immediately. And most businesses don't seem to have that kind of cash on hand. So that might thwart business in general if that happens. And no great relief in sight for them, too.
Right. And we can hope for grace that, you know, they'll have some time to be able to come up with those retroactive wages and hope that there's some leniency within that. But you just never know nowadays. There's no crystal ball, you know, and I wish there was.
In the normal event, that's always true. But it seems to be, especially now, with so much uncertainty around this and around a great many other issues. Thank you so much for coming in. Good to talk to you.
Thank you so much.
Debbie Padello is Director of Operations of Simplicity HR by Altress, where she oversees the Human Resource Administration Services for more than 1,000 clients and 14,000 employees statewide. Today, as we were talking about, was supposed to be the start of the Fair Labor Standards Act, now in limbo due to an injunction from a U.S. federal court judge in Texas.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want to do.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. A man I knew was a paraplegic. He was completely paralyzed from the chest down. He rarely let this inconvenience, as he called it, get in the way of his fun. But every time he visited me here in Hawaii, he became frustrated that he couldn't go into the water at the beach. This was a man we'd decked out in full scuba gear and lowered into the ocean from a boat, but he couldn't make it across the beach, much less surf or snorkel, because there was zero access. The folks at Access Surf are working with injured veterans and disabled kids to overcome this issue, and they're successfully getting them into the water. They've taught kids with autism to surf, which helps them perform other tasks in their daily lives. They're a nonprofit organization and survive on donations, so they offer their service for free. Access Surf Hawaii has a dream of not only providing accessible beaches, they want to provide programs for families with disabled people to reconnect with the ocean. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
Mele Kalikimaka and happy holidays. This is Daniel Anthony. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio.
Beth Ann, tonight at 5, we bring us Town Square, and we kind of hope at the end of each year that we've made some progress in homelessness.
And because homelessness has been such an issue for us for such a long time, and we've seen so much movement around homelessness in the last year, 18 months in particular, we thought it was time that we just go and take an overview of that and see where we are now and what's how we're going to be moving into the future. Scott Morishige is going to join us, the state homelessness coordinator. Also, Rona Fukumoto, she's the division administrator of Housing Assistance and Referral Programs for Catholic Charities, and Anthony Alto, who you might remember we had on the show not that long ago, right before the premiere of his film, No Room in Paradise. And also we're going to be talking with Stanford Carr. He's also been very vocal, and we've talked to him before about that nexus of homelessness and housing and really what we ought to be focusing on and what those barriers are, and particularly the ones that he sees because he's a developer.
We've seen small victories over the year, but have we seen the kind of coordinated effort that everyone agrees that we need?
Right, and that's part of what we're going to be discussing tonight, and we want to hear from those who are involved with this too, because our table is only so big, and there are certainly issues happening and ways of approaching homelessness that are different from island to island, as we've known when we talked to the mayors. So we're going to try to give as much of an overview as we can of all this and set us up for where we may be going in 2017.
Be interesting to see what people who call in have to say, too.
Always is.
That's tonight at 5 on Town Square. In today's Backyard Quiz, we asked you to give us the name of a film shot on Kauai during Hurricane Iniki. The year was 1992, and Steven Spielberg was coming off directorial hits Hook and Schindler's List. He was at the helm of a new project filming on Kauai when Iniki made landfall during production. The Category 4 storm proved devastating to Kauai, destroying homes, businesses, and landmarks. Spielberg and his crew were caught completely by surprise, waking up to the weather reports on the last day of filming. Iniki destroyed many of the film sets and forced the crew to shelter in their hotel and ride out the storm. Despite the carnage outside, the crew managed to capture a few shots of the storm as it passed. These ended up being used in the final cut of Jurassic Park's climactic sequence, which is set during a major hurricane.
And we had a caller who knew that. Sean Nakoa called in. She phoned from Kona. And this was also a very popular quiz, but she had fast fingers, and she gets the prize, so it'll be on its way to you sometime soon. If you have a backyard quiz for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, and you just might hear it on a future show. It's now 8:49.
Kalo, also known as taro, has sustained the Hawaiian people for as long as anyone can remember, and in the manner of staple foods around the world, is at the heart of their history, culture, and spirituality. Kauai's Hanalei Valley, home of the Waipa Foundation, is one of the richest kalo-growing areas in the state, and it's the setting for the Foundation's 7th annual Kalo Fest this Sunday. Colin Kelikoma is putting the event together, and he's on the line from Kauai. Good morning, Kalen. How are you?
Good morning, Chris. Good, thanks. And you?
Sure, I'm pretty good. We're talking about a lot more than food here, aren't we?
Oh, for sure, for sure. We're talking about music. We're talking about education. We're talking about folks getting together and having a great day.
Well, I just mean with Kalo also, that's it would be way too simple to just say it's a food. It's a cultural, how shall I put it, kind of a cultural flashpoint, yeah?
Oh, it's the center of our culture, one of our main staples, food-wise. It's our older brother. It's family.
Yeah, I've never, one of the things I think that's distinctive about it is the way it has its place in Hawaiian culture as an actual ancestor, right?
Correct, in one of our stories of creation, because every culture has their story. And so we come from Kalo, from Haloa.
Tell me a little bit more about that, if you would.
So in one of our stories of creation, we have Papanuakea, the Earth Mother and the Sky Father, and their firstborn was stillborn, and they named him Haloa Nakalao Kapalili, the quivering leaf. And so they buried him. And from that spot, that's where the first Kalo grew forth. they had a second son, and they named him Haloa also. And so it was the second son's, Kuleana's, responsibility to tend to his older brother, to take care of the kalo. And that's the relationship that we have with each other, where we have our kupuna, our elders, take care of us, the keiki, the offshoots, the ohana mm-hmm. from the kalo. And we, in turn, feed. The relationship goes back and forth, taking care of each other and feeding each other, not just physically, but spiritually and mentally.
So is the root of the word keiki that you just used refer to offshoots as well as directly to children?
Well, the offshoots are called the oha, so that's where ohana comes from.
Uh-huh.
So when you have the kalo, when you have the makua, the parent, in the middle, all of the oha, the offshoots, the keiki, surround the parent.
So there really is, that really speaks to the very central presence of kalo in the culture, doesn't it?
Yes, yes.
At the Waipa Foundation, you're managing an ahupua'a, and it's a complete ahupua'a, yeah?
Yes, it's 1,600 acres. It's one of the few ahupua'a intact, and it's the Kamehameha Schools, the Bishop Estates. We stored the land for them.
And do what with it?
So we actually do most of our work in the lower 300 acres. We have a fish pond that we're restoring. We have two gardens. We're not certified USD organic, but we practice the best methods that we can to try and be organic. We have a native plant nursery where we're propagating native plants and also fruit plants, introduced plants that we're outplanting in different parts of the valley. We have lo'is, probably about 5 acres of lo'i that we take care of, and we're not commercial. We're not farmers in that sense, where we're growing that much taro. And we grow the kalo for educational purposes with the groups mm-hmm. that visit us. So we're constantly planting and harvesting with the groups that visit.
Who are the groups that visit, Kaylin?
Well, just this week we had Tutu and me, so we had about 40 keikis with their parents or grandparents. They came over in the morning, and they actually came all the way from the west side, from Keikaha, which means they got up really early to come out here to the North Shore. When they got here, they made poi, and then we took them over to the lo'i, and it's hard when you have three-year-olds to, make them pull weeds.
Yeah.
But they get to go into lo'i and have that experience. And so that's just an example. We have elementary students that come, and as depending on what the group is capable, like what kind of workload we can give them. Mm-hmm. It can be anywhere from weeding to removing invasive apple snail eggs to cleaning the awai, the ditches, and that's when we have to get in the water system with sickles and cut back the grass. And we're constantly doing that to keep the water flowing.
Do the kids bring a degree of enthusiasm to this when they come to visit and you put them to work?
Oh, for sure. And, it's important that we get out of the classroom, and when you're Aina-based, when you're land-based, the learning doesn't stop. And I think magic happens when they come here. And again, they're excited to be here, and this is something that they normally don't get to do, so they get that experience. And hopefully we're planting a seed so that they come back, or they'll take what they learn here and take it back to their home or their whatever island they come from.
But you certainly can see a lot of enthusiasm in youngest generations coming up in Hawaii these days, don't you think?
Definitely. There's a pride there. When I was going to school, I didn't have this experience growing up here. Kind of skipped our generation a little bit. I'm not going to say how old I am. but, now there's all of these opportunities for students, which is super maikai, really good.
It certainly is. Thanks so much for talking with us, Kaylin.
Oh, no, thank you.
My pleasure. Kaylin Kelly-Koma is the coordinator of the WIPA Foundation's 7th Annual Kahlo Fest this Sunday from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Hulu Fish Pond at WIPA, just about a half mile out of Hanalei, Kauai. Details can be found on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page. Giving kids a chance to play in the mud and help with the taro at a lo'i has got to be an appealing thing for young children, yeah?
Well, playing in the mud is always fun, but yeah. I want to know how he gets a three-year-old to go out there and actually continually pick weeds out.
Well, you know, I was just looking at the WIPA Foundation's website, and it's full of great pictures of kids just with big smiles on their faces, and they really are doing some work out there. Good to see.
And the truth of it is that, you know, when you do it and you gently guide and you have a child out there in any type of gardening activity, there's just some magic that happens.
That's
right. It's really a wonderful thing to watch. For us, we've got to watch the clock, and it's telling us we got to say goodbye, but we're going to be back with you tomorrow. And we'll be talking with the head of the Civil Rights Commission, the State Civil Rights Commission. Yesterday, they were calling on Hawaii to oppose the trend of discriminatory harassment. We'll talk with Linda Hamilton Krieger about just that and include some of our conversation that we had earlier this week with Neil Milner.
And actor John Rubenstein comes to town to share the lessons of decades of stage, film, and television experience.
Meanwhile, if you want to be in touch with us, there are lots of ways for you to do it. You can call our talkback line. We like that one because we get to hear you in your own voice. Please just be sure to leave us your name and the town from which you're calling. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. And if you check our Facebook page at Hawaii Conversation, you can leave us a lot of information there, too.
Past shows can be found under The Conversation at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll see you in the morning with more of The Conversation.
NPR's From the Top with host Christopher O'Reilly returns to Honolulu for a live taping tomorrow at 8 p.m. Featured are the musical talents of our own Hawaii Youth Symphony and 4U Ukulele Quartet. Celebrate these extraordinary young people. Visit hawaiipublicradio.org to purchase your tickets now. Supported in part by the Sidney E. Frank Foundation.
The Takeaway is next on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. KIPO Honolulu, KIPM Waikapu, KHPH Kailua Kona, KIPH Hana, KIPL Lihue, and KAHU Pahala. Collectively, the stations of HBR2. And the time on the islands is 9 o'clock.